Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
I mostly write about how humans relate to technology.
And I mostly write about how popular culture and movies and stuff like that relate to humans.
This is a very special episode of Still Processing.
And by special, we mean it's Friday.
Mm-hmm.
We've never released an episode on a Friday before, so we apologize for that.
No, it's TGIF. It's exciting.
We don't really apologize at all. Sorry, not sorry.
No.
That was my okay. Demi Lovato impersonation. Don't you like it?
It's cute. I do like it.
Okay, so we've got such a big show this week. We're going to talk about this little movie called Black Panther.
Tiny little movie called Black Panther.
And discuss the recent boom in black male superheroism. And then to help us do that, we're going to talk to the vision behind Marvel's latest series of Black Panther books, some dude named Ta-Nehisi Coates.
You may have heard of him.
But before we do that, Jenna, what is going on with you?
Well, we have such a big show, I don't want to take up too much time, but I just want to toss out like a quick tip to our listeners. A friend of mine over the weekend was walking around a mall and she got a random dick pic via AirDrop, which is the iPhone like software transfer whatever program. So yeah, so weird creeps, they can cyber flash you by sending you pictures via AirDrop, which is basically like Bluetooth. Anyway,
oh,
there's a very easy way.
My stomach.
Yeah, no, it's disgusting and it's awful. This is a new thing. It's been going on for a little while, but whatever. There's a very easy way to avoid it. So my thing this week is a tip to all of our listeners who want to avoid being cyber flashed, which is go into your AirDrop settings and turn off everyone and turn on contacts only, or just turn AirDrop off altogether. But you basically only want to ever get AirDrops from people you know.
I don't think I want an AirDrop at all now. Now it totally sounds dirty.
To lighten the mood a little bit, I did tweet about this and I got a reply from none other than the Queen Jackie Harry, who wrote, "What? Turning my AirDrop on," which was hilarious. So
Mary. Mary, I need a dick drop, Mary.
That's basically what happened.
Oh my
God. So what's new in your world?
Listen, there's a lot of terrible things happening in the country.
Yes.
There's a budget. There was a school shooting this week. I want to kind of lighten the mood as much as we possibly can. One thing's been on my mind that hasn't depressed me for the last week.
Can't wait.
And it's this Vulture Q&A with American legend Quincy Jones, who is clearly just almost 85 and feeling himself.
As the kids say, IDGAF.
Uh-huh. At all.
Okay, he's lit.
At all. He's in full-on gangsta mode in this conversation with David Marchese. I think we should do everybody a favor right now and just do a little reenactment.
You want to do a dramatic reading of this?
I just want to do a little bit of a dramatic reading.
Okay.
Starring me as David Marchese and the one and only Jenna Wortham as the one and only Quincy Jones.
Let's I'll do my begin. Best drag king impression. All right, let's go. Marlon Brando used to go cha-cha dancing with us. He could dance his ass off, man. He was the most charming motherfucker you ever met. He'd fuck anything. I mean anything. He'd fuck a mailbox. James Baldwin, Richard Pryor, Marvin Gaye.
He slept with them? How do you know that?
Come on, man. He did not give a f-. Hey, you like Brazilian music?
Yeah, but I don't know much beyond Jorge Ben and Gilberto Gil.
Gilberto Gil and Caetano Veloso are the kings. You know, I visit the favelas every year. Those have a hard life. They're tough, though. You think our shit America's bad? It's worse there.
I just want to pause for a second and say, Quincy is in the favelas?
I don't know. He takes a taxi around. It's not like it's hard to go
Quincy's
to the favelas.
Quincy's on a drone. This interview proves that Quincy travels by drone. Continuing. I read that as a young man, you used to carry around a 32.
Yeah.
Did you ever fire it?
Oh, yeah.
At what?
Just practicing.
Okay. Let me ask you a left field question. In your memoir, there's a section where you talk about...
being a dog.
That's not what I was thinking of, but yeah, that's in there. I was thinking of a section where you describe having a breakdown not long after Thriller.
Oh, mm-hmm.
You talk so often about your ups. I'm just wondering if you maybe can talk about one of your downs.
Okay, what happened was I was a producer on that movie, and then everybody went on vacation after we finished filming. Everybody but me. I had to stay home and write an hour and 55 minutes of music for the movie. I was so tired from doing that, I couldn't see. I put too much on my plate and it took its toll. You learn from your mistakes, and I learned I cannot do that again.
And that was the Vulture Q&A. Just a tiny sample.
Our first table read.
Between Quincy Jones and David Marchese. I have to say, holy F, I can't believe I actually stopped to ask about the Favelas and not about Marvin Gaye, James Baldwin.
No, I mean, honestly, that little tidbit made my entire life, because then the internet dug up pictures of Brando and Baldwin. Gave me a lot of good material, if you know what I mean. So
let's take a break. We're done with Quincy, but we're never really going to be done with Quincy Jones.
Facts.
But we'll be back to talk about Black Panther. 1 second.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Tell me something. What do you know about Wakanda?
It's a third world country.
Textiles, shepherds, cool outfits.
All the front. Explorers have searched for it for centuries.
Yeah.
The Golden City. It's a technological marvel.
Okay, we have some important business to talk about. Namely, that this movie called Black Panther is opening. We saw it together, and we had a great time.
We had a really good time.
I should say that before we saw it, I was all but out of shape because I, without having seen this movie, was reading a lot about it, and a lot of it was people losing their minds about this movie existing, and you got to support this movie, and you got to go out into the streets and tell everybody that you want to see it. And part of me was just like, I don't think I need to do this for Disney
right,
and Marvel.
Right.
They're okay.
Right.
They don't need a street team to make you know Black Panther is out there.
Right. We don't need a hashtag campaign to like get people out of their, you know, out of their seats to go see Black Panther.
Kickstarters to get kids into the movie theater.
Yeah, there was a lot. There was a lot of like preemptive hype that always makes me like disinterested a little bit.
This is like a cycle that we go through every 2 or 3 years,
right,
with some mostly black or all black movie. And the thinking, at least since I was a kid, was if you didn't go opening weekend, Hollywood's going to think you don't want it and they'll stop making it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in my lifetime, this was true for Malcolm X. This was true for Beloved. It was true for Catwoman. Boomerang in 1992, same year as Malcolm X, If you didn't go see Eddie Murphy make love to Robin Givens and then Halle Berry.
Right, right.
And Grace Jones is in the movie and Martin Lawrence and David Allen Greer. Anyway, if you didn't go see Boomerang, there was never going to be another black romantic comedy.
Right,
and
right,
every time
right,
one of
right.
these movies didn't do as well as they thought they were going to do, as Hollywood needed them to do, you didn't see anymore. And sure enough, there was no sequel to Boomerang. No, like, you know, cousin to
right.
Boomerang.
Even like a psychic sequel.
Right, right.
right.
And there's a way in which I'm having a little PTSD with this Black Panther enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hold my black loyalty against me if I'm not in the mood
right.
to watch Black Panther. I can't support that. But anyway, we went.
We sure did. And all that saltiness melted away once the title credits started, right? I mean, we both we were waiting. And then we exhaled, and then we really enjoyed ourselves.
It's a good movie.
It's a great movie.
We should explain what Black Panther is about. Mm-hmm. Ryan Coogler co-wrote and directed it, and it is the story of King T'Challa, who rules the fictional kingdom of Wakanda,
uh-huh.
which is a country, fictional country in Eastern Africa, and he has come into power and is basically defending the kingdom
right.
from outside forces. There's an attempt to steal their incredibly valuable vibranium, which is, among other things, when applied to his Black Panther's costume, his suit, his mm-hmm, excellent mm-hmm. cat suit.
Super excellent cat suit.
Is a sort of force-absorbing element that can absorb power and then give it back.
The key here, though, is that there is this fictional African nation that is set aside from the traditional storyline of what we think of as Africa, and it's never been touched by an imperialist force. It's never been touched by a colonizing force, and it's in possession of this very rare and very transformative element called vibranium that has the ability to transform the landscape. It can imbue anybody that consumes it with superpowers. It can be used in all these incredible ways, which is why the nation of Wakanda is so wealthy and is so technologically advanced.
Yes.
It's in possession of this, like, yeah, this incredibly rare and precious and super powerful mineral.
And Black Panther is an honorary position that has been held for many centuries by
right.
many kings of Wakanda.
All of this is based on a comic created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in the 60s, and it was introduced as a character in the Fantastic Four comic book series, and then it went on to become its own standalone comic book series in the same way Wonder Woman was.
But the movie, we should say, is just, I mean, it's fun. It's really smart about blackness and the sort of different ways of the blackness function among black people. And it is not terribly concerned with the white gaze. There are white people who come in, but they are used in a really interesting way to make a point about an entire history of movies. I mean, it's very much responding to me
yeah.
to a movie legacy as much as a comic book legacy.
One thing that struck me when watching it is how much care was applied to mm-hmm. every single mm-hmm. element mm-hmm. of the film. And I was doing a little digging and reading about the costume design, the production design, the set design, the hair design. Pretty much everyone that could be black was black. You know, there were mm-hmm. no hot combs on set. And there were, there was very much care paid attention to natural hair, mm-hmm. like braids, dreads, like really imbuing beautiful African and African-American hairstyles. There were no light-skinned people on set.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
there was, and also I kept noticing, like, whoever did all the makeup, everyone looks so dewy, so mm-hmm. resplendent, mm-hmm. like highlighter mm-hmm. on fleek.
Yeah.
And then I was reading an interview with the production designer. Shout out to Hannah Beechler, who did the production design for Wakanda, who also worked on Moonlight, who also worked on Lemonade, who just paid such delicate care to every single scene. And, you know, I read an interview with her where she said, you know, she studied Senegalese warriors for mm-hmm. some of the tribal outfits. Like, she mm-hmm. just looked at everything very, very carefully. Fresh haircuts, beautiful, intricate beadwork. work. I mean, you could just feel it. There was a real sense of dignity and respect for Africa and African-American cultures that you never see on screen. Mm-hmm. And it just made me, like, feeling that kind of care. It cocooned me as a moviegoer and made me feel cared for in a way that I rarely do. Like, all that worry that you have when you're going into the theater and there are black people on screen and, like, what's going to happen? I don't know. Like, you, just, like, that little nervousness in the pit of your stomach was just dissipated.
So I was incredibly skeptical. I did not. I mean, I wanted to see it, obviously.
But you were grumpy about it.
I was very grumpy just about, like, our desperation. But then I thought about something that was really important to me.
Okay.
Which is that this, to me, is the last time I can remember a comic book movie being this seismically big a deal was Tim Burton's first Batman in 1989.
God. Wow, wow, wow.
And it is a similar, this is a weirdly similar situation here with, you know, Prince doing that soundtrack and Kendrick Lamar's doing this one. There was no precedent for what was about to happen in terms of getting this mega budget name director to bring back to life a moribund franchise, right?
Mm-hmm.
In this case, Black Panther wasn't moribund as a movie franchise,
but
They're just strangely similar cultural events.
Yeah.
And this one is more specifically stoking black people. I mean, everybody is going to see this movie.
Everyone's going to see it, but it feels especially seismically, I love that word, it's especially important right now when blackness has never been more under assault on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not
mm-hmm.
talking about the movie screens. I'm talking about our phone screens and brownness too, really.
Right.
But just, I don't know, as I was watching the movie, and the thing is, I saw all those Batman. I've seen every superhero movie in a theater. Like, I like that kind of action movie. Like, I see them all. And, you know, I kind of went in like, yes, obviously this is dope. The cast is amazing. The soundtrack, everything's going to be on fire, you know. And then I was sitting there thinking, like, this movie is really about the unassailability of blackness and the resiliency, but just the glory of it, you know. And it really, really shone in my heart, you know, and just thinking about where we are right now culturally, where we are in our country, what the news is like. It felt so important to me for moviegoers, white and black, really for black though, for black people, just to be able to just lose yourself in this fantasy for 2.5 hours.
I think there are a lot of, like, non-white people who are going to feel special just by experiencing
a world that
is not under white assault.
And, like, untouchable by white assault. That's the thing.
Yes.
And then the movie really does prioritize and really showcase blackness as a technology.
Mm-hmm.
In a few moments, we're going to grab Ta-Nehisi Coates to come in and talk to us about this movie and the franchise and the whole thing and why it's such a big deal. In 2016, he revitalized the Black Panther series for Marvel with a brand new series of comic books. The thing we should say, too, is that people went nuts for it. Like, I tried to buy it several times. Ta-Nehisi's, you know, a friend of ours. We've obviously known him for a while. Wanted to support the book. Didn't realize the book didn't need my support. Could not find a physical copy of the comic book anywhere in New York. I had to read it on my Kindle. Have you ever read a comic book on a screen? They're not meant to be read on screens.
People,
it's impossible.
Do it,
well, it's very hard. I'm here to tell you. It's very hard to do. But yeah, I mean, you know, basically people went nuts. And that started this part of this conversation that we're having, which then led to the Coogler film.
So we're glad it's here. The thing that's very moving to me is that this guy is, like, there's a home for him in Wakanda, there's a home for him in the Avengers movies, in which, you know, these movies are a tributary toward. There's a lot to be thankful and grateful for, I guess. Thank you, Marvel and Disney. But really, thank you, Marvel.
I was going to say, thank you, Ryan Coogler,
right? I mean,
for doing this justice and giving us some. Because at this point, it's not even really about Marvel and Disney. It's about what Ryan Coogler is now doing. And this film is already on track to be one of the biggest opening weekends in Marvel's history.
Any movie's history. Right.
So it just feels, the movie's very ripe for propagation. It's very ripe for sequels. It's very ripe for just being this entire world on screen that we've never seen before. And before we go, very quickly, one thing we do have to talk about is, at the top, we were saying male black superheroes. But in the comics, Black Panther's little sister becomes Black Panther 2. So who knows? It might not just be about some dude named T'Challa.
Amen. Amen. Let's go get Ta-Nehisi.
This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
We're back. And we wanted to talk about Black Panther, but we also wanted to talk about the different contexts and histories that explain the movie. We couldn't think of anybody better to do that with than Ta-Nehisi Coates, the author of The Beautiful Struggle, Between the World and Me, We Were 8 Years in Power, and a writer at The Atlantic. But most importantly, he's the man behind the series Black Panther, A Nation Under Our Feet, which was illustrated by Brian Stelfreeze. He's here in the studio with me and Jenna. So what's happening?
Not much. Not much.
All right. So Jenna and I were just talking about this great time we had at the movie.
Right.
Our minds were blown because I was a little skeptical going in, not about the movie.
Right.
But I was just annoyed about the enthusiasm
for
the movie. The build up.
Can I say one thing?
Yes.
It deserved it.
Yes.
I'm not even saying having seen the movie. Like, I usually get annoyed at hype, but the possibility of this deserves the hype, I think, actually.
Mm. How do you mean that?
Yeah.
What did you know going in? You usually have an all-black cast, basically. You knew that, you know, you were going to have Lupita, Denai, Chadwick, Michael B. You knew Ryan was going to direct, you know. I don't know how you guys felt about Creed. I just think Creed is incredible.
I love Creed. I also love Michael B. Jordan so much. I mean, you know. You heard me the whole movie.
See, this is what I mean, right?
I got the bruises on my arms.
Letitia Wright, though, too. Right. I know. Right. I was dying. I was just like, anyway.
So it was like, that's hype worthy.
Yeah.
I'm biased on this, you know, because me and Ryan are friends, but I think he's a once-in-a-generation talent. I really, really believe that. So... You know, I talked to him about the movie, and when people would ask me about it, I was like, it's going to be the best Marvel movie. You know, that's subjective, you know, and we can debate that. But, I mean, I don't think any of the other Marvel movies assembled this level of talent.
Mm.
And I don't, you know, and again, you guys did an episode, I guess, a few weeks ago, and you talked about Proud Mary, and you talked about black women as, you know, action heroes. Again, you guys will notice a lot better than me, especially you, Wesley. But I have not seen two black women like that.
No.
I've been searching, trying to think. When she got on top of that car,
billowing,
I was like, wow.
Yeah.
That, for me, was the moment, too, where I was like, in that scene, two things happened for me. Sorry to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Okay. But I wasn't really a sorry, I guess. But the things that happened for me in that moment was I was like, oh, okay, I've been waiting for a black Uma Thurman and Kill Bill. Like, oh,
yeah,
okay,
yeah, yeah.
I've been waiting for my black Penny for Inspector Gadget. Like, I was waiting for my black Fast and Furious. Like, I didn't know how much, like, I had ignored the desire because I never thought it'd be fulfilled.
It's that there was a kind of completeness to both of their characters that I ain't seen that.
Yeah.
Right? Black Panther is actually a tough thing to do. It's tougher than it looks. The character was not created by Africans, much less black people at all. And one of the problems with writing T'Challa is, I don't know how much this was intentional, but he's almost like a paper cutout propaganda piece against racism.
Yes.
You know, more than, like, I mean, he's smart, most technologically advanced civilization in the world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Handsome, strong, like everything that you would say to refute notions of racism, which, I mean, is beautiful and respectable. But when you try to write that, it's difficult. It's not like Marvel heroes in general have some really prominent deep flaw. Captain America is a man out of time. Spider-Man, great power, great responsibility. X-Men, hated, feared. T'Challa's like Superman. I mean, you know, he's right, almost like, at least that was, you know, that's a way he's been written. And so, you know, and I know Ryan, you know, dealt with this. I know I dealt, you know, I deal with it all the time. So where are you going to find that? Where are you going to, how are you going to get into that person? How are you going to get internal? You know what I mean? And find the conflict. And he didn't just do that with T'Challa. It is worth looking at how Okoye and Nakia look in the movie. And how they've traditionally looked in the comic book.
Right. We're talking about Lupita Nyong'o and Denai Gurira's characters.
Yes, it's worth contrasting that to understand how much work he actually did. M'Baku, do you know in the comic book, this guy is a black man in a gorilla suit.
Yeah.
That's who that is. And it's like, what am I supposed to do with that? Like, it's no...
Yeah.
Like, when I started writing the comic book, I was like, oh, this guy can't appear in the comic book.
Right, right.
Like, this just can't happen. You know what I mean? But he rehabbed him. He just made him something new, you know? You know, he did a very similar thing with Creed, though. You know, where there's a basis of problems here.
Yes, he took a movie franchise that began, I would say, in a sort of fever dream of white supremacy.
Right, exactly.
Which is you know, Sylvester Stallone as Rocky going up against the world heavyweight champion Apollo Creed.
Right.
And losing the fight, but winning the movie.
Right.
And you watch that movie and you have no idea what, who lost?
Right.
I don't actually know what happened.
Right.
And, you know, we'll never lose.
Everybody, you know, a lot of black people, like my dad told me a story when I watched Rocky with him. It was like Rocky III I watched with him, the Mr. T one. My father told a story about in 1976, you know, watching that movie in Philadelphia, where I'm from. In a theater with, you know, a half white, half black audience, and it was borderline race riot in the theater. Because boxing and race and the movies have a really incongruous history with the reality.
It's the inability to actually show a black.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
But very similar to what he did. I mean, he took the worst elements. Rehab and then found the best elements.
Yeah.
Right. He did the same thing here. The worst elements, you know, in the comic book, as far as I'm concerned, are the women.
Interesting.
And they became arguably the best element.
But that actually gets at this larger thing we've been talking about with the movie and the revitalization of the franchise and sort of its origins. And now we're taking something that was very problematic and problematized in all these ways you described, and we're reclaiming it and really owning it. And even putting all these big labels on it. Like, how do we reconcile the origin with the present day iteration?
God, that's so African-American, isn't it? I mean, but it's like the essence of us. I mean,
it's
the essence of us, you know? And so I think part of it is, like, hasn't there always been this history of pop culture that we kind of felt was problematic? But it was what you had.
Yeah,
right.
Like, my parents wouldn't let me watch Good Times, right?
Mm.
Like, they just wouldn't. They wouldn't let me watch Good Times and the Jeffersons. But Good Times and the Jeffersons are, in many ways, iconic for black people in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to listen to Prince. That's a different thing. But,
wow.
I mean, my mom tried really hard. I think that's why my parents got divorced.
Yeah.
Because my dad was like,
no, there was a lot of that in my house. Like, my mom hated Billie Jean. She wouldn't let me listen to Billie Jean. Because of politics. There's a guy not taking credit for his kid.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean? So there's always this, like, thing. You know what I mean? Maybe what, like, sets Black Panther apart is you can't imagine a black parent telling a kid you can't watch this.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's
a very
that's a great
hard
point,
to imagine that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think along those lines, I've been thinking a lot about precedence and the way that Black Panther originally functioned versus the way he functions now, to me, is a lot like the way Sidney Poitier function.
Yes, yes,
you know,
yes, yes,
in the 60s yeah. and then yeah, the yeah. like late 50s. Yeah. I mean, Sidney Poitier is essentially a white invention.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Similar to Black Panther, mm-hmm. you know, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee took a look at, you know, the comic landscape, their own basically, mm-hmm. because, you know, Atlas Comics was mm-hmm. theirs and then Marvel was theirs. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have, there were no black superheroes, mm-hmm. basically. So they invented one. And they invented one to be an anti, of a symbol of an anti-racism. Mm-hmm. This is the most perfect specimen of black, of blackness.
Right.
You can't use any of the things that the right. civil, the anti-civil rights mm-hmm. movement people, the mm-hmm. segregationists, the racists, the Jim Crow people, are using against black people. Because look at this superhuman specimen.
Perfect.
Right.
And Sidney Poitier, for a long time, was a difficult person for black people, eventually became a difficult person for black people to be purely proud of because it seemed like he was being used. And yet, he was great,
right.
nonetheless.
Right. Yeah.
And he eventually transcended his use as an instrument. Mm. I would say, I don't know, have you guys seen In the Heat of the Night? There's a moment where he slaps this old racist man. It's 1967. Mm-hmm. You know what's happening in America at this point.
Right.
In terms of race relations. And he slaps this old white man. Mm-hmm. And I think that basically ruins his career.
Mm-hmm.
His career is...
Are you serious?
I would say he's at the height of his fame in 67. Slaps this guy. I mean...
Heat of the Night is the height?
In the Heat of the Night comes out the same year as Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and To Sir with Love. These three movies are huge hits, make him the biggest star in the world. He gets no Oscar nomination for In the Heat of the Night. Rod Steiger wins the Oscar. Katharine Hepburn and Spencer
so
Tracy
good.
Are both uh-huh. nominated. He gets nothing. He's already won the Lilies of the Field Oscar at this point. But after that, I mean, he does a couple action movies. He moves into directing, but he really became... He was already in the civil rights movement, Sidney Poitier, but he became much more aligned with black power struggle at that point,
wow.
as opposed to being this symbol of a kind of white guilt
mm-hmm.
and being used to shame white racism. He becomes a filmmaker who basically winds up making blaxploitation movies.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he spends the entire 70s making movies for...
And was that exile, though, or was that, like, choice?
I think I would argue it's an exile and a choice. Huh. He looked at his options,
right.
saw what was coming. Mm-hmm. The studio right. system that built him fell right. apart.
Right.
And these young kids who were coming in, the sons of these moguls, they didn't care about civil rights.
Right.
And there was no place for him to go. He was basically an old man at that point in the huh. eyes of these people.
Interesting.
And Warren Beatty and Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda and, you know, a bunch of other people, Jane Fonda, it's not that they didn't care about civil rights, but that wasn't their issue. That
yeah.
wasn't their cause. They were more about the war and, yeah. you know, free love and, you know, banishing this generation of old fogies. They mm-hmm. didn't... Black power was black people's problem.
Right.
And they wouldn't stand in its way, but it wasn't like having Marlon Brando and Paul Newman and Charlton Heston standing with
right.
Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte and Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King.
Right.
That kind of activism, it just died.
He's
so interesting.
Anyway,
he said a lot of other really good things. You're kind of getting at it, but there's more. There's so much more
but,
inside
but
that
I'm
brain.
Just, all I'm saying is that like Black Panther at the same time, I think in comic books is doing uh-huh. a similar thing.
That's right.
In the late 60s and early 70s.
Huh. But so how do we extrude that though through the lens of Marvel? Because what Marvel is doing and really the whole superhero universe that exists right now is... I mean, are there other parallels between then and now that we should be concerned? Not concerned about, but I'm just wondering because these things are, you know, cyclical.
Well, you, Ta-Nehisi, can talk about... I'm actually curious to hear you talk about what you wanted to do with this series, knowing everything you know about Black Panther and you know, the Marvel DC universes
mm-hmm.
and how...
How they function.
Superheroism functions in general and how black people function within that.
Well, I mean, I guess it goes to my background, which is pretty curious. I grew up in a vaguely like black nationalist household.
Mm-hmm.
And I say vaguely because my dad was kind of this idiosyncratic character, but he had been in, you know, literally the Black mm-hmm. Panther Party himself. You know, it was a place where, you know, it was a very Malcolm X household, not so much a Martin Luther King household. Africa was a big, if it was an abstraction as an idea, it was a big thing in our imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got the comic book, I thought about all of these things, all of these ideas, all of these myths provide actually quite strong ground to actually write this mythical place,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very much interested in pulling from like the diasporic imagination of Black people to write the comic. I think Ryan took that to another level.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because I've read a lot of reviews and I don't think people... white people are really getting this, but this is, if we still use this word, and I think for this movie we probably should, this is like a Pan-Africanist movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It really is. I mean, that's it actually real. Is. I mean, from the ideas, from the theme, you know, and its basic mm-hmm. idea of, you know, connection, you know, it's connection between African society and, you know, African-Americans. But it actually goes beyond that. You, at various moments, will have on screen a Black person from South Africa, a Black person from Kenya, by way of Mexico, a Black person from London,
mm-hmm.
a Black person from Trinidad mm-hmm. and Tobago,
mm-hmm.
a director, you know, from here, a star, you know, from here. I mean, this is like wild. Again, I'm struggling for, compared, the executive producer was Black. The costume designer did an incredible job. Ruth Carter, who worked on, you know, Malcolm X and did
the
all
legendary
of those,
Ruth
legendary,
Carter.
Yeah. Legendary. Did all of those great, you know, Spike Lee. So it's not just the idea.
Yeah.
Literally, the film is. Being at the premiere and seeing that was like...
Well, let's just
historic.
Talk about that.
Yeah, like
what,
tell us. Well,
what was that like?
Tell us everything. What'd you wear?
What did you
wear? You know, I'm a square. I wore a suit. I wore a straight 3-piece suit. I'll show y'all at the end. But, I got a couple personal connections to the movie. You know, I went to school with Chad.
Chadwick Boseman, who plays Black Panther. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I knew him back at Howard. I saw him in plays that, like, my friend Camilla Forbes, who's executive producer up at the Apollo now, like, that she had written. And I, like, saw him. You know what I mean? In these plays, like on stage with like only like 20 or 30 people in the audience. So I, you know, known Chad for a while. So I was like, A, incredibly proud of him.
Mm-hmm.
I have this really unlikely friendship with, you know, Ryan Coogler, the director. And I just say, you know, unlikely. I just didn't expect to. You know, Ryan's a, you know, in many ways, just a, you know, a straight, you know, down to earth brother. But I just didn't see any of this coming, you know. So unlikely in that sense. And so I was, A, like, incredibly proud of them.
Mm,
you know, mm-hmm. just incredibly, incredibly proud of both of them from a personal perspective. I think, and I don't want to overestimate this, man, but I think that crowd was, like, 50% Black at a premiere. I mean, that's, like, huge. And the after party might have tipped up to, like, 70, 80. You know, I didn't see Downey there. I didn't see Ruffalo there. I didn't see ScarJo there. And that's no disrespect to any of them. I'm not saying they should have been there. I'm just trying to paint.
It just wasn't that kind of party.
It wasn't that kind of party. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It wasn't that kind of, you know, thing. And I, you know, it's so funny because the wife, man, she said, listen, I don't, given your for her, you know, relatively recent prominence right now, I don't ask much out of that, babe. But you gotta get tickets for Black Panther for me.
Shouts to Kenyatta. She was like,
yeah, she was just like,
make it happen.
You gotta get it done. She's like, I don't ask for nothing. But this right here,
it's my one favor.
This is my one favor. And I kind of didn't want to go. You know, I was like, it's gonna be a show. I don't want to, you know.
Yeah,
not
you're like
show.
Me that way. I do not premieres, they never start on time.
Yeah, and this one didn't. And we showed
and
up
you
on
know
time,
this
which
was
a huge
start on
no,
time.
No, it was a huge mistake to show up on time.
Right.
To actually
right.
rush in. That was a huge, I did everything wrong. But she's like, we got to get this done. So I called, you know, was able to, you know, wrangle an invite. And she was right.
Yeah.
I mean, she was just right. I mean, it was historic. It was so, you know, you go in and you see the film and, you know, you see, and they're showing, you know, by the time we had gotten there early, so they're showing people come in on the red carpet. Chad shows up, like, and he gets out his car and that African drummer's greeting him.
Yeah.
And that Dora Milaje, like, right there with the spear.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And he walks in, the brother that plays his father, they interview him. This cat like was like on some radical, you know what I mean? Like I was like, man, they gonna have to cut this dude's interview because they were streaming it and he was just going on how revolutionary, you know, this film was for Africa and Africans have been depicted as savages. I was like, wow, is this happening? Like somebody saying this?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know what I mean? So he comes in Snoop is there.
Yeah, who else was there? Like,
I mean, just everyone.
Everybody.
Just everyone. Yeah. David Oyelowo was there, you know, and the Dashiki. All of this, obviously, all of the, you know, everybody that was in the movie was there. I mean, and most, probably about 70% of the people in African get invitations that, you know, royal attire. Mm-hmm. Only an idiot like me, like, I couldn't interpret that. So I was like, oh, I guess I'll wear a tie.
Yeah, but lots of Africans wear suits. I mean,
you're fine. I don't know. I was crazy out of place there. So you watch the movie. Movie's incredible. Movie's incredible, right? People, by the way, are applauding all the way. I don't know if this happened when you guys saw it.
Oh, yeah, there were claps
throughout.
They
applaud, like,
screaming
even,
Wakanda, which was great.
Oh, all the way through. Like, even through. When bad stuff happened to T'Challa.
Yeah.
When Michael B., that scene where he says, put me in the ocean with my ancestors. You know what I mean? With the sharks, you know, because they knew it was better to die free than die in a cage. Man, that theater, that was so African-American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, and I guess like any, you know, Caribbean also, you know what I mean? In that sense, but anybody whose experience has gone through slavery, that just cut right to the core. And, you know, people just sort of, not so much like clap, but just applauded inside. And you have to understand, we're seeing this in a Marvel Comics movie?
Yeah, that's the mind-blowing
that was the part,
you know?
I like, mean, this ain't Roots.
Yeah.
like, this is not, this is like Marvel, this is in the Marvel universe.
Right.
And I don't think any of those movies have had, I mean, their politics in the subtext of, say, you know, Civil War or, like, the Captain America movies had a subtext of politics.
Right.
But it's really there.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, yeah, this strong. Is, yeah, it's the, funny that you, that's a really good distinction, actually. Just because I think, you know, one of the pleasures of this recent, you know, these recent Avengers movies is, I mean, it's not always successful, but there is some attempt to recognize the real politic nature of what superheroism would mean in 2018.
Right. Right.
Something the comic books did a good job of being aware of the way the world worked, too.
Right.
But that the movies are acknowledging that, like, the way the Pentagon might work in a world full of superheroes is just really fascinating to me. This is not something that most people, you know, the average white moviegoer, I mean, forget white. I mean, most non-black people are thinking about in this particular way.
Yeah.
But really, the struggle in this movie is not between white people and the people of Wakanda.
This is us.
It's between black people.
Right.
It's between black people, and it's also about the choice of revealing the strength of blackness and the resources, the inherent, and not
that's
even
so
about vibranium,
true,
but the
that's
inherent
so
resources of blackness.
That is so true.
Like, that's, you know, this decision of what happens if the world knows about Wakanda. And actually,
God,
it was
so true.
The idea too, like, what would it be like to realize that everything you thought about Africa and the African experience is not necessarily a lie, but there is a potential otherness that we can't even comprehend. That's the scariest thing to the world.
Yeah.
That there is this alternate that could have existed. And I think that's what kind of really got me, though. That was, like, gutting me.
Jenna, you're so on point with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something I had that was vaguely in my head, but you really just articulated, because I think, like, this is the sort of thing, like, on some level you say, oh, this is myth, there's no African society like this. But if you understand it as allegory,
yes,
and you understand, like, how central, say, black people have been to the West,
right?
If you're thinking about culture, if you're thinking about all these questions of, you know, what people call today appropriation, if you're thinking about the conversations we have all the time about how much to reveal ourselves to white people, I mean, this is a constant theme, you know. Like, I have friends, you know, who won't, like, drink, like, at work parties around white, because they don't trust white people. You know what I mean? This is like a thing that we all have of how much of ourselves
can we show?
Can we show to the world? And this is all about that. That's a great point.
Yeah. I mean,
and even, like, the taking, like, it's just, you know, even thinking about how something like Twitter functions, like, there are constant mutations to try to hide the black culture that thrives on Twitter. For a while, it was using the hashtag on here, right? Like, there's all these deceptive techniques to try to conceal the Wakandan-ness that exists.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's funny because black Twitter
always gets co-opted as
a police force.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Trying to keep out and call out.
Right.
You know, it's really interesting. It's totally fascinating.
And it's, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, and I don't know if this quote is, it's almost too good to actually be true, so it might be apocryphal, but there's a lot of truth in it, was allegedly asked about bebop one time, and he said, we wanted something, quote, that they can't play. You know, this notion of something that we so wrong.
Incredible.
Yeah, but it's like we're hiding again. You know, we did jazz. We got to hide again. We're always trying to hide.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, oh, they're up on this. So now we got to hide. We got to go, you know what I mean, do something else that is our own, you know? And so in that sense, you're right, man. That's
We're constantly re-encrypting the culture to try to keep.
It's a technology. Yeah. Like, we have that technology.
But there's always a bot. Yeah. There's always a bot. Yeah. But I do.
By the way, can I just say, as a total Marvel fan, really quickly, this is just fan-ish right here. I think this is the movie that says, at least in this cycle, DC can never catch up.
Oh.
They can never catch up.
I think that's real.
That's real.
I think
because
say.
But only because of this movie. Of course, eventually movies can get good, right?
Right.
And so it could be that at some point they get it figured out and they, you know, make a string of movies. Did you say, oh, these movies are as good as the Marvel movies? But a Black Panther?
Yeah.
Not even just because it's Black Panther, but because it came, because of the story Ryan decided to tell.
And
how can you duplicate this?
I mean, DC does not have, they just don't have
the resources, really.
I mean, they could take their Black Green Lantern, but they messed up the white Green Lantern. Like, nobody wants, they didn't want Ryan Reynolds. I don't think they're going to want, like.
They don't have a story and they don't have a director. Yeah. I think it's those two. I think, what Jenna was saying about resources, the material is not really there to go and do something.
You can't follow this movie, though. I mean, you can't, I don't know. I mean, obviously you can, but it will present a really interesting challenge. But then I think about Ava. Right? Yeah, she was assigned to direct this originally. So I'm still like, I still
Black
think
Panther?
About, she was initially attached and then she and Marvel parted ways and now she's doing Wrinkle in Time. And I'm actually like, I want to see that superhero movie. Like, the whole time I was watching it, I was like, what would the women...
Ava DuVernay's Black Panther. That's interesting.
That would have been very interesting.
I mean, she might do Shuri as Black Panther. I mean, it's still a possibility. But the whole time I was thinking, like, there are going to be so many interesting ways to watch this different permutations and just like all the different splicings. Like, I got really excited at the end of all the ways this could like fan out in the way that all these other movies do. How many Spider-Mans have there been?
Oh, God.
Right?
Yeah. Well, the multiplicity, I mean, the sort of one, this is our only shot at something, is something I was trying to get at earlier when I was explaining, Jenna and I were talking
that
about.
That was our frustration, the feeling that if this movie doesn't do well, like, not annoyance at the hype, because it, of course, yes, like, there's, we're all excited, but the annoyance that, you know, there's somehow pressure on us to make this succeed because this is our only shot. Like, that feeling is just really
Man, you
deeply.
You know, I knew it was going to do well from the moment it was announced.
Yep.
The hunger for a mythology among Black people is strong, you know?
Yeah, and I guess Catwoman doesn't have that. I mean, with all due respect to Halle Berry,
I mean,
and how that movie, but people were gunning for that movie to fail also.
Right, but I mean, like, among Black people, like, the excitement I thought was going to be so high. And I think this is, again, you know, speaking of, like, as you say, the things we hide, there is a thing among white people when they see Black people ridiculously excited like this, where they say, huh. Like, you know what I mean? Where it becomes, maybe we should go over there. It might be something over there, you know?
But this happens every 3 years, it seems like. Well, apparently, Get Out was a hit. I guess people want to...
I think this is different, Wesley.
I think it's different.
I think the excitement on this one
This is an order of magnitude.
But no, not even quantitatively. I think, like the type of excitement is actually different than... Like, Black people saying, hey, we really, really like this movie.
Right.
You know, like, Girls Trip is, you know, great. And obviously a lot of Black folks and a lot of Black women were excited about Girls Trip. Like, he's answering big questions about home and what we're tied to and who our heroes are and, you know, what are our myths. You know, I've talked to Ryan about this, too. Like, Ryan, you know, when he was working on this, he said something to me. He said, listen, my dream is to have Black folks as successful in, you know, film as they are in the NBA. And I was like, that's absurd. And then I thought about it, and I thought, no, it's actually quite right, because the point he was making in that conversation was these stories, you know, Fury Road, which I adore.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Mm. Lord of the Rings, like, you can, the if
Game
you
of
were
Thrones,
looking for the
geez.
Real world, yes.
I mean.
The real world idea that embodied that in America whose history would you reach for?
Right. Well,
we are aliens. We are alien abductees. Right. Yeah, we are the original science fiction story. Yep. I mean, a lot of has been discussed about how this movie fits into all these different science fiction parameters, and people are having a lot of fun with it. But it's like the fact that there isn't more black science fiction is a function that makes no sense whatsoever. It's like we are the original. We're the original Close Encounters.
Here's the problem. If you do that, then white people become Agent Smith. Like, the orcs are not, vaguely black, actually white. Like, it changes. That's the problem. In order for them, if you do, there's one black person in Fury Road, which is a movie about runaway slaves.
Right, yes.
Like, totally about runaway slaves, you know what I mean?
I'm with you. But I will say the one thing that I'm excited about and interested in that this movie did not do for me, is that I am very interested in scenes and dioramas and fantasies of blackness that do not involve whiteness. And this movie disregarded whiteness, but everything about this movie was set up in opposition to whiteness. Everything about Black Panther as an icon and as a figure is refuting an idea of blackness created by whiteness. Mm-hmm. So I am actually interested, when I talk about the African American experience as alien abductees, I don't even want, to me, Moonlight is a science fiction movie because there's no whiteness in it. Mm-hmm. And it imagines a world of blackness.
But Jenna, there is.
Well, there is, but
there
like, is. It
they
imagines.
They created the
it's
environment.
The gravity.
Right.
It's the gravity it's that's there. Okay. It's pulling, you know what I mean? When he gets taken away after he, hits that kid with the chair, that's whiteness taking him away.
Pulling him away.
Yeah, well, I mean, the projects themselves are.
The question that you have to ask yourself is this. If you take out whiteness, what does that look like as an identity? Is it just a bunch of people with brown to high yellow to dark skin? Is that just
I don't know. That's the science fiction of it to me.
And if that's the case, why is it only that? Like, what are we then? You know what I mean? Like, even if you think about black people, right? Physically, we look so different from each other. Like, if you consider the diaspora, right? There's no real phenotypical unity except some sort of direct connection to some person that was deemed black at some point in some amount of African. But this is a wide span of people that goes from people who literally look white, you know what I mean, to like the dark, to the dark. So what are we if we take whiteness out? I don't know the answer to that. You know what I mean?
I do think this movie tries to answer that question. And I do think this movie, I'm trying to think of how not to spoil it, but there is a moment at which the movie tries to ask a question, what did whiteness do to blackness? And it tries to really, I mean, there's a moment in which you see someone who maybe is polluted by this exposure to whiteness and what whiteness has done to blackness. And they're posited as kind of evil, right?
But understandable.
Understandable. Evil. Like, no, they're not faulting that. It's it's more like a, the reaction is more of a, it's a damage to your damage.
Right, I would say it was more trauma than
it's
evil.
It's the trauma than evil. But but I mean, they're seen as a threat to the way of the Wakandian life. And I guess that to me was the most interesting thing of like, I don't look at myself that way. And like, maybe we have to think about this, the influence as a sense of, I mean, we do, but to see it on screen like that was also devastating to me.
Can I offer something in terms of what you've been talking about? Like, something happened this week that when you're talking about what you're asking for, I think it felt like a partial answer to me this week when we saw the First Lady and the President's portraits.
And you love these so much.
I do.
I love your love of these.
But I will just say that there is something about Amy Sherald's style that is so much about what if there was no white gaze to give us blackness as it's been given to us. Amy Sherald, to be clear, is the woman who painted Michelle Obama's portrait.
And there's because she used kind of a grayscale in the tone, there's a real outcry. People are so attached to Michelle's complexion that they can't, it's like a, I'm not saying it's not justified. I'm just curious. I'm watching it unfold. I think it's fat. I don't know what I think about it yet. I'm riveted by this, the way in which the fact that Michelle's skin is not brown is seen as just gutted, right? But go on.
Is that because you, and black women particularly, but black people certainly are not used to seeing somebody of that skin tone hailed internationally in a beautiful sort of way?
It might be. It must be that that's the sense of loss that's being experienced. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I think it just feels in some ways like she's been divorced from her blackness in some way.
But and it's like undeniably black know, when you look at that point.
We don't
though.
Know how to. I mean, it's like a lot because a lot of what people are saying with her with this painting is that it doesn't look like Michelle Obama. And you never really quite, a lot of people aren't very specific about what that means. Mm-hmm. Does it mean that her skin's not brown, or does it mean that, like, her face just doesn't look like Michelle's, that the painting's face of Michelle Obama does not look like what we think Michelle Obama looks like,
right. Mm.
But I would say to that, have we really looked at Michelle Obama? I always think about this, too, like, when it comes to the movies that we love by and about black people, African Americans in particular, what is the story that we are telling about ourselves? We give Tyler Perry a hard time all the time for the representations of blackness, but that is our blackness. He is giving black people a version of themselves that in many of these movies has nothing to do with white society. He has imagined his own kingdom of
is that true.
Yeah.
Does it really have nothing to do with white society?
I mean, there are white people in some of these movies eventually.
No, but I don't mean that. I mean, I'm going back to the moonlight thing. That gravity is really absent.
I would say in Diary of a Mad Black Woman, Daddy's Little Girls, there's very little white presence. But I mean,
do I finally have to watch a Tyler Perry movie?
No, you don't
I'm writing
have
these
to,
names
but
down.
What
I'm gonna
saying
do it.
Is he
I
his,
try, Jonas.
I'm not saying that you have to
watch
the
movies. No, you're making a great point, though.
I'm just saying that he is trying to create a world
that's real.
That where the traumas aren't the usual traumas, right? They have some connection to them, but like, why did I get married? That is...
God, I tried with that one.
I know. It's not great, but it offers a world in which you have these characters who exist unto themselves.
Why does he heap so much abuse on the women
yes,
in these
well,
movies?
That's a...
What
that's
is a, that? Yeah. Like, he likes watching these women suffer or something?
I think Ta-Nehisi...
Like Jill Scott in that movie.
If we're going to stay on this tangent, I think Tyler Perry is identifying with these women. And there's something about something in him that... I mean, I'm not going to say he thinks he's a woman, but I think there's a kind of... Black
That's
female
he's mapping.
Pain
uh-huh.
that he sees in himself. Uh-huh. He may not even know this, uh-huh. but to me, for Color Girls, that was a Tyler Perry couch session. All of those women were some aspect of his psyche, not any identifiable black woman I know. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you something? In this moment that we're in right now, because it feels like there's a lot of prominent black people in TV and film. If someone were to do For Colored Girls, would they go to Tyler Perry again at this moment?
Well, no. Yeah. No, but I mean, he took that upon himself.
Yeah.
I mean, Tyler Perry is an independent artist who does what he wants.
But would it...
I don't know. No. Yeah. I mean, someone might fight a little bit harder to either stop him from doing it or to just make their own version. I mean, lots of books and plays get other versions of beyond, like, you know, the first one.
Right.
I do think this is the right movie for right now. Like, I the whole time watching Black Panther, just going back to it again, though, is, you know, I think all these other questions aside about the hunger, like you were talking about, like, my hunger is different from maybe the collective hunger, but I was still fed by that movie showing me Black people using technology, not having it used on them, right? You know, like all the things we see every day. I was just like, I just actually, this movie was a coconut water. It was a Xanax. It was a vacation. It was a good meal. It was like so many, it was an IV drip. It was a B12 shot. It was so many things I needed just to, you know, palate cleanse.
I can't get it out of my head.
Well, damn, Jenna.
Are we going to go again to Court Street and see it?
Can we? Definitely.
Yo, I
want to
go to a good screening.
Yes. Magic
so
Johnson
let me
Theater.
Know. Let me know when y'all
the party
going.
Magic Johnson Theater. That's
let
gonna
me
be
know.
A lot, but
no,
that's probably sold out for
we
like
should
the next
just
month,
go but. In super incognito and just sit in the back row.
Oh my
Court
God,
Street.
I so want to do that.
All right, let's do it.
So, because that's like, different than the premiere audience.
It's
that's
gonna,
a
yeah,
different. I so want to do that.
Okay. That's a date.
That's our show.
Thanks for listening.
Still processing as a product of the New York Times.
It is produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman, whose birthday is today.
Happy birthday, Jenna!
Josh Gwynn, Ann Hepperman, Henry Malofsky, Jessica Jupiter, Maddie Sprung-Kaiser, and Max Linsky from Pineapple Street Media.
Our editor is Sasha Weiss, and we get editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
Our theme music is by Kindness. It is called World Restart from the album Otherness.
And you can find all our episodes and other stuff at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. And remember, if you feel like leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, we won't say no. And we also just want to say one more thing. We're still looking to hear from you guys for our upcoming episode about Asian racism, Asian American racism. We talk about racism all the time on the show. We would love to hear stories from our Asian listeners, our Asian American listeners, about their experiences, their frustrations, things in popular culture that drive them nuts.
And the way to do that, so you can give us a call and leave us a short voice message at 405-458-4237. And you can also email us or send voice memos to stillprocessing@nytimes.com. Thank you so much for sharing. We're really excited about this episode.
Thanks for listening.
Go see the movie. Tell us what you think. Bye.